everybody, and welcome to our newest episode of Banterbox, a review podcast run by the team here at Mad Artists. Each week, we will be reviewing a different production, whether it's a movie, TV show, book, etc., and this week, we watched Big Fish. My name is Danielle, and here are the Mad Artists that I have with me to help break this down today.
Hey everyone, it's Samuel.
Hey. It's John. I thought that was kind of a given.
And we have another guest with us today. We have our friend Adam. Say hi, Adam.
Hi, Adam.
So, Adam, tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
All right. So, hello, everyone. I am Adam Farmer. I am a, actor, writer, storyteller, and podcaster. I have a podcast called Fiction Crime Time that you can find pretty much wherever you get your podcasts. It's basically a true crime podcast, but without the true part.
So it's all like, is it, because I know you mentioned that some of it is from like Wizard of Oz. Is it from different stories as well, or just like Wizard of Oz?
We'll find out in season two.
Okay, cool.
right now I'm just investigating crimes committed in the land of Oz, and if I end up in other worlds, we'll see where that goes.
Nice. All right. Well, so
the
I know.
The world may never know.
Yes, the world may
like
never
the
know.
The worlds may never know.
Ooh.
So I know, obviously, Adam, you had seen this movie before. You've seen it several times.
Yes.
I had never seen this. Had any of you guys seen it?
No, actually, I have not.
I had neither seen nor heard of this movie.
I had heard of it for years, and I had seen the movie poster of, like, you know, the big fish and the tree branches, like, so many times. And, like, I had seen specifically the image sort of at the beginning of older Edward Bloom, like, you know, kind of casting the line out while he's standing in, like, just the middle of the lake, like, several times. But I had no idea what it was. I didn't know it was Tim Burton. I didn't know anything about it. I was just like, oh, okay, this looks like a cool, like, sort of emotional movie, judging by just the poster. Like, mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah, this movie gave me off vibes. I don't remember the name of the film. But there was a movie, I want to say it was, like, in between Iron Man 1 and Iron Man 2. Where RDJ did it was, I think, called The Judge.
Yeah.
It was very reminiscent of that film.
Like, just poster vibes or the movie?
Just the entire, like, from what I saw of, like, as I saw the movie, I drew parallels to it. It reminded me a lot of that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I just got a lot of, like, Forrest Gump and No Brother Where Art Thou.
Yeah, Danielle was comparing it to Secondhand
Lions. Yeah, I saw a lot of Secondhand Lions. Yeah. Like, the whole, like, you know, flashing back to stories of, like, you know, these older men and everything. Yeah. I was like, I see so many similarities.
And the question of whether it's true or not.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
I was going to say, this is a very interesting, I mean, just from a storytelling standpoint. We're pretty much, as an audience, in the falling action. And it's just constantly being interrupted by, like, all right, here's everything that led up to a point. Back to the falling action.
Yeah.
Everything led up to a point. Back to the falling action.
Yeah. But, well, you say it's falling action, but I would argue the climax of the movie is when he's actually, like, dying and Will is having to, like, make up the end of his story.
Yeah, well, it's two different plot lines we're following through the whole thing. You have the plot line of Edward and his life and what's going on there, and then you have the whole other plot of Will trying to find out who his father is. Mm-hmm. So it's like we start out in the falling action of one plot, but in the rising action of the other.
That's fair.
Right.
Yeah.
Because in Edward's storyline, we find out, or in Will's storyline, we find out about Edward's storyline.
Right.
Which is why you get that weird
right.
falling action versus rising action.
Yeah. There were a lot of cool things that I noticed just like all throughout this movie, and I know Adam has a ton to say about it.
I got a notebook.
So, before we get into the plot, this movie came out in 2003. It was directed by Tim Burton and written by John August and is based on the novel by Daniel Wallace, which Adam actually has here with us today. And it stars Ewan McGregor as young Edward Bloom, Billy, I think it's just pronounced Crudup, which is a very unfortunate last name, as Will Bloom, and Albert Finney as old Edward Bloom. You can buy or rent this on Vudu, Prime Video, YouTube, Google Play, or Apple TV. And the IMDb summary for this says, a frustrated son tries to determine the fact from fiction in his dying father's life.
And as expected, as per every Tim Burton film, starring Helena Bonham Carter.
Oh, of course. Yeah. It's
although I don't know that she's going to be doing anything with him anymore because they broke up.
They're divorced.
I mean, yeah, but I mean, still in classic fashion during that time frame.
Yes, during that time frame, I think she was literally in every
2000s.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm surprised I didn't see Johnny Depp in the film.
Did she voice act in all of his, like,
I think that once they got together, which was late 90s, until they broke up in, like, 2016, I think she was in every film he did in that time period.
Did he do Corpse Bride?
Yeah,
I would like to say so.
Yeah, he did. He
voiced it.
Who was she in Corpse Bride?
I don't know.
Because, I mean, that was all animated, so,
was
like...
Was that early 2000s, though, or was that...
I'm pretty sure it was mid-90s. Early 2000s.
I don't know.
I got
that. I just know I watched it in my childhood.
It wasn't 90s, because I remember whenever it came out.
Because it had that same, like, stop-motion feel that a lot of Tim Burton stuff has that scares Samuel. He doesn't like stop-motion. It scares him a lot. Like, I told him that I loved the old claymation Rudolph. And I was like, I love it.
Dude, it's so good.
It's also one of the weirdest things ever. Yeah, I watched it recently.
She's the main character.
In Corpse Bride?
She's the Corpse Bride?
And Helena Bonham Carter?
Yeah.
Yeah, she is. She's Emily.
Wow. Okay. I didn't expect that.
I told
that.
Y'all, she is in, like, every single movie.
I knew she had to have voice acted in some... Oh, you know what? Now I hear it. I just heard her voice. I played Corpse Bride in my head, and I heard it, and I was like, yeah, that's Helena Bonham Carter.
Oh, and apparently Christopher Lee was Pastor... Galswell's.
Oh, Christopher Lee.
He was in a couple of Tim Burton movies.
I love Christopher Lee. RIP Christopher Lee.
I don't know a lot of
rest
actors,
in peace, Count Dooku.
So I don't know who
Count
you're talking
Dooku.
About. Oh, okay. Count okay, Dooku. Okay.
Saruman.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, now Count I know who you're talking Dooku. About. Yeah,
Saruman.
Yeah. All right, well, Samuel, you want to tell us more about our big boy director and our writer?
Yeah, I might have heard of Tim Burton. He's done a couple of things. You probably know some of his stuff. He did the Batman movies in the 90s, the first two, not the Joel Schumacher ones. He did Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands, Sweeney Todd. I mean, Frankenweenie, I think, was him.
Didn't he do Coraline? Was that him?
I do not believe so.
Oh, it's in that same vein. Yeah. So I just thought it must have been.
But yeah, he did Corpse Bride, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Planet of the Apes.
Nightmare Before Christmas? Was that him?
Nightmare Before Christmas was produced by him. He didn't direct it.
Okay.
I
just hear I see those stop motion things and I'm like, that's Tim Burton.
I think he wrote the story for it and he produced it, but he was already contracted to direct something else.
So he just was like,
I think that might have been during Batman Returns. But yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. I'm always interested to see his live action stuff because the first things I ever saw of his was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Corpse Bride. And so, like, I grew up, like, watching those movies, and so I just knew him, like, as those. So I was like, okay, his live action is super weird. And then his animated is also super weird, but in a very different, dark, creepy way. And so, like, as soon as this one started out as live action, I was like, I'm very interested.
Yeah. Well, and it was interesting to me because, like, all the flashback stuff felt very Tim Burton-esque.
Yes.
But all the other stuff, it felt like it was directed by two different directors.
Yeah.
Like, it did not feel like Tim Burton.
Which is the point of the whole movie.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Which was fantastic.
Yeah. I loved every time it flipped back and forth because it really did feel like a
well,
totally
and what
different
was weird
thing.
To me was seeing locations in both. Like, seeing the... And I don't even know if I can explain it properly. But, like, seeing their house... Edward Bloom's house that they live in when they're older, seeing it in the past story when they first get it and all.
When it's all, like, vivid colors.
Right, exactly.
And
then seeing it again when it's just a normal house, it was very surreal.
See, that's all camera angles because, to get the Tim Burton feel, like, you look at the house from such a low angle, so it looks like
so
a big castle.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then you come back to just the normal, and it's just a straight-on shot of the house, and it's like, oh, it's a normal
house.
It
just looks totally average. Yeah.
Well, I will say this much. As per the usual, Danny DeVito stole the show.
and he reprised that role in Dumbo.
Oh my goodness, did he really? Was he that? Was he the ringmaster?
He was the ringmaster.
I haven't
in Dumbo.
Seen live-action Dumbo.
Which was also directed by Tim Burton.
Quick note, before we get into this, I did not know that. Mm-hmm. Before we get into this, it was written by John August, who has written a ton of stuff. He wrote both Charlie Angel's movies. He wrote Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Corpse Bride, Prince of Persia, Frankenweenie, Aladdin. Aladdin.
So he's just worked with Tim Burton on a ton of stuff.
He's just done a ton of stuff.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I wouldn't have expected Prince of Persia. I saw that like ages ago, way, way long before when I was surprised it was a Disney movie because it was actually PG-13. And oh, I was like shocked.
And now Disney's doing an R-rated movie.
See,
I know. their whole vibe unfamiliar has to change now that they have Marvel.
With the movie. Definitely familiar with the video game. I've never seen
Prince of Persia. I've heard it's pretty good, but
I saw it once a long time ago, and I thought it was good, but I didn't have like a desire to rewatch it.
Prince of Egypt was great.
Oh, Prince of Egypt is a fantastic movie.
It makes me tear up every time.
It's so good. The music from that is fantastic. Plagues.
I just listen to the soundtrack every day.
The soundtrack is so good. I have downloaded like a lot of just random songs from old animated movies, like on Spotify. And that's one of them. I was like, Prince of Egypt, let me just go through the soundtrack. Oh, I want that one. I want that one. Like, it's so good. But yeah, so anything that y'all want to talk about before we jump into the plots?
Well, this is kind of an interesting fact, like, while we're talking about, like, director stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So, actually, it was, I think, Steven Spielberg was, like, asked to direct it originally.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
But something came up, and Tim Burton just got finished filming Planet of the Apes, which is why he was like, I'll take on the project, and we are all thankful that he did, because it is beautiful.
Apparently, that was one of my little fun facts I had, is that he was attached to the project and actually wanted Jack Nicholson to be the star.
Yeah, and I don't know how
that would have worked at all, but apparently it was just his full schedule that he had to, like, he couldn't add on anything else. He had too many things, which isn't surprising. It's Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
At Will Bloom's wedding party in 2000, his father, Edward, recalls the day Will was born, claiming he caught an enormous catfish using his wedding ring as bait. Will, having heard these stories all his life, believes them to be lies and falls out with his father. Yeah, the whole time with Will, I was like, I was trying to figure out like why he was so upset with it, and I started to figure it out the more that the movie went on, because the fact is, Will is not in a single one of his father's stories except for that one. And even then, it's just, and my son was born. And like, that's it. Even the one time you see Will in any of his flashbacks is that one shot of the house. And he's like, hey, dad. And then his dad just waves and drives away in the car. Like, he pulls up, waves to say hi, and just keeps driving. And the son is just kind of like holding a football. And I'm like, okay, now I get like the resentment a little bit. I understand.
I mean, he even says it later on. 'Cause you find out, you eventually find out what Edward actually does for a living later, like midway or late middle of the movie.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, like he tells his wife, Will tells his wife, I didn't see my dad much as a kid. Like, he just wasn't around. So like,
and at first he was like, and I really like the line where he's like, at first I thought maybe he had a second family, but then I thought, what if he doesn't? And like, that's so much worse, because then it's like he never even wanted a family. Like, he just sort of wanted like the ideal, you know, sort of like, I guess, nuclear American family, where he's just like, you know, I want the white picket fence. I want the beautiful wife that, like, you know, I fell in love with at first sight. I want, you know, a strapping young son, and I want to be able to go do whatever I want and not have to be around them.
The robbing scene was the best scene in the whole darn film.
That was a great scene.
Oh, boost gaming.
But yeah, along the lines of like the whole father and son thing, like it's not just that he wasn't there, it's that because he wasn't there, all he heard about his father's life were these stories.
Mm-hmm. Right.
These unbelievable stories that, I mean, and we kind of see Will, he's a realist. Like, I mean, isn't he like a journalist or something? So he's going for
I think he's just an author, but okay.
I think he was, because he was working at the newspaper in the first
show. Oh, okay.
And I think what I took away, especially later in the movie, is when they said it, and this is what, when I really understood why Will was so upset, is when he was talking to his father about, or he might have been when he was talking to his wife in bed, about how long it was before he realized that it was all a bunch of crap. And imagine growing up, imagining that, okay, your father's never there, but it's because he's off on all these great adventures.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all this stuff. And then you get older and you realize, oh no, it's just because
he was never around.
Just imagine, like, that would be like,
yeah,
just being in school and being like, oh, my dad did a bunch of this cool stuff, and the other kids are like, dude, that, yeah. that stuff's not real.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Will sums it up in a pretty decent line on how he views his father. He's like, I wish I could quote it directly, but I think the line is something along the lines of, you're like the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus mm-hmm. mixing the yep. one happy bundle.
Yep. Yep.
Like, yeah. And he says,
just as charming yeah. and just as fake.
Yeah. yeah.
Just as charming and just as fake.
Yeah.
And he's like, you think I'm fake? And he's like, well, you've been telling me all these crazy things my whole life. What else am I supposed
to think? But honestly, all that resentment and like, it makes for a hell of an ending.
Oh, yeah, dude. yeah.
Which we won't get
to. Yes, we're going to get there. We don't need to jump all the way to the
I'm
end
sorry,
yet.
I'm sorry. You know me. I bounce around.
I know. We all do. So 3 years later, in 2003, Edward is stricken with cancer, so Will and his pregnant French wife, Josephine, return to the town of Ashton, Alabama, to spend time with his father. During the plane ride, Will recalls a story of Edward's childhood encounter with a witch who shows him his death in her glass eye.
Let me start with the witch. So first off, this is where we get a glimpse of, like, the whole, how Greek mythology kind of ties into this.
Oh, yeah, because it was like the fates. Like,
yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I know what you're saying. Oh, the fates. Aren't there three? Yes, there are. And there are three in this movie. Let me get to it. So we see the witch and, of course, like the eye because, you know, fates and the eye. Mm-hmm. This witch in particular, the fate is Atropos, which is the one that like cuts the thread of life and everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, like, basically looking into the glass eye tells you how you're going to die and yeah. when. So that's, like, the first glimpse that we see. And, I mean, I'm just going to say it right now. Throughout the story, we see, like, these kind of glimpse into these little mythological tales. Mm-hmm. But we also see, like, Edward Bloom's twist on it, where mm-hmm. he's like, here's the story that you know, but here's me just overcoming this whole story and not giving you the ending that you think it's gonna get.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right.
That was his whole thing, was just always, like, I really do think that, you know, there were definitely, obviously, as we see at the end, you know, bits and pieces of truth from all of his stories, whether or not the entire thing was true. Mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. all these people show up from his past and are like, you know, talking to everybody and like, not everything is accurate, you know, like the twins aren't conjoined or anything, yeah, yeah, yeah. but they're there and they are like, you know, the same as he described them except for that. And so it's like, oh, okay, you know, he didn't completely lie. He just sort of like embellished on truths.
I mean, and that's what I'm sure that's what any of us would have done when Will realized that, oh, it was a bunch of crap. He threw it all out in his mind. He said, okay, mm-hmm. so none of this was real. And of mm-hmm. course, life is never that simple.
No, life is never that easy.
And, you know, and I really love the line. And again, I'm going to go to the back end of the movie. Dr. Bennett makes a great line of, of where it's like, well, between the first story and the fantastical version, I would rather much tell you the fantastical version.
But Will, being the realist that he is like, I don't know, I kind of liked your version because I know it's the truth.
Yeah.
Like,
and another thing to think about, like, just these stories in general, like, as we go through, think about, like, we're not actually seeing the story as it's told. We're seeing the story as it's formed in the imagination of the listener.
Yeah.
And because of that, like, there's some stuff that's going to be skewed. And also, like, you'll see with each story, there's a moral. Because, I mean, this was Edward's way of, like, teaching his son different things.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the bank robbing scene, for example, is like, oh, here's how you can invest your money into these fairy tale stuff. You know?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. All of them really were, like, you know, different little, I mean, they were, like, bedtime story, you know, fairy tale type things, you know, like things that you read to children that have a larger moral. Mm-hmm. But instead, he just made it having to do with real stories from his own life, but made them, you know.
He summed up perfectly. They're tall tales.
Yeah.
They're the classic tall tale example of,
It's very reminiscent of bedtime stories with Adam Sandler.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. That's what I was thinking about on the way here. Like, it's this fictional tale that parallels with reality.
Yeah. Right. Where there are lots of places where reality and the story intersect, but not everything is cohesive. Yeah. So Edward, in spite of his illness, continues to tell the story of his life to Will and Josephine. He claims to have once been bedridden for 3 years due to his rapid growth spurts. He then became a locally famous sportsman before being driven by his ambition to leave his hometown. I thought that was cool. I liked that sort of interpretation where he was like, you know, the goldfish will fill whatever space it's in, which again is another, you know, fish kind of symbolism. And then he's like, oh, well, if I'm growing this much, then I guess I'm not supposed to stay in, like, you know, a tiny little town. Like, yep. I'm supposed to go and, like, see all these different things. So it was, like, instilled in him in a pretty, like, young age that he wanted to go off and, like, do all these crazy things and accomplish as much as he possibly could.
And just to kind of ruin that a bit. so this is my theory.
Yeah.
Don't quote me on
no,
this.
No, you're good.
But... Just think about it for a minute. This story may have been told to Will around puberty.
Right.
Mm-hmm. About, like, you think your body's changing. How about I was in bed for three years?
Yeah. And that's another thing that I saw him continuously doing. Like, every time, you know, his son would be sick or his son would be, like, you know, or he would have gotten hurt or something, like, he'd be telling him, oh, that's nothing. Let me tell you about the time this happened to me. Yeah. And I can see why he wanted it to be comforting. But at the same time, you know, as Will grows up, he's like, you were just invalidating all these things that I was going through. Like, you know, like that's where I started to be like, okay, I can totally see where the resentment started to spawn, where he's like, I just wanted you to comfort me and be there for me. And instead you're like, what you're going through isn't anything. Like, I went through something way worse. And it's like, okay, thanks for making me feel like, you know, like I can't be upset about my situation, you know? He sets out into the world with a misunderstood giant, Carl, who was terrorizing the town by eating livestock from the surrounding farms.
Oh, Carl.
Cyclops.
Yes. Very much yep. Cyclops.
Yep.
Very much.
Mythology 2.
Yes, Edward and Carl find a fork in the road and travel down separate paths.
Sorry, I just wanted to throw this in because I quoted it. That the advice that the witch gives him before he leaves is the biggest fish in the river gets that way by never being caught. Now, we know from the end, spoiler alert, Ed's the fish.
Yes.
You know? Yep. And so I'm like, okay, well, what's trying to catch him? And then we find out death, you know, death is trying to catch him. And we know that because of all these stories, like Will says at the end, he becomes immortal. Death never catches him because he's the biggest fish in the river.
Immortalized. I mean, it says at the end, immortalized in his story.
Immortalized.
Mm-hmm. He said immoralized.
Oh, immortal. I'm from the South. Pretty I don't know
difference.
How to pronounce it.
Yes, there's a very big difference between immortal and immoral. Yeah, there's so much mythology stuff. So yes, definitely stop me and point out any of that as we're going, because I am obsessed with mythology. I absolutely love it. So like any moment in this when I saw something even slightly mythological, I was like, I think I know what that's from, but I'm going to hold on and see if it's true. But yeah, so they go down different paths and Edward follows a path through a swamp and discovers the secret town of Spectre, the cheery locals claiming that he was expected. There he befriends Ashton poet Norther Winslow, a.k.a. Steve Buscemi, and the mayor's daughter, Jenny.
Jenny!
However, Edward leaves Spectre, unwilling to settle down, but promising Jenny that he will return.
Okay.
I knew you were going to have something to say, so I was like, I'm going to pause here.
Okay. First off, there is like a little cameo of... the movie Deliverance, like the banjo kid playing the dueling banjos.
Was that actually him?
That was actually
him. Okay.
The kid from Deliverance. But nice. Also, so the town of Spectre is like symbolic of the Lotus Eaters in the Odyssey.
Yes.
And it's definitely made clear because of the line. I honestly can't remember who says that. I just wrote it down. Somebody says, bloom like a flower. And we all know Edward Bloom and then the lotus flower. So, I mean, I kind of made that connection there.
Yeah.
It was the wife. I want to say it was the wife that said the line.
Yeah, I think so. And she also says, oh, you're quite a catch. Which parallels with the whole trying to catch up.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's not bypass also the subtle siren thing with
I wrote that down.
With the woman slash fish that they talk about.
And like the snake that was just a giant ass stick.
Yeah, it was just a stick, but it was meant to like draw him into the water. Like that was the whole point.
Again, I can't believe I didn't put Lotus because I knew there was some sort of like symbolism or like reference there that I wasn't picking up on because it was very too much. It was too dreamy. I was like, this is either a reference to heaven.
Yeah, or, that's what I thought first time I watched it.
So for the first. Like, while we were in there, that's what I thought. But then once we started coming back to it later and seeing other stuff with it, I was like, okay, so no.
No, yeah. I didn't ever picture it as heaven, but I didn't remember the Lotus Eaters until you just said it. And then I was like, that's exactly what it is. But at first, I almost thought of the town in A Wrinkle in Time, where everyone is sort of living the exact same life. Where, like, you know, all the kids play with the ball in the exact same way in their driveway. All the parents, you know, come out and call them in at the exact same time in the exact same manner. It started reminding me of that, and I was like, oh, I don't like all the creepiness with it. Towns like that creep me out in movies more than, like, anything else.
Also, I will admit, and this is because I was raised in Disney. My dad loves Disney. It also gave me vibes to the island from Pinocchio.
Where
it was like...
Pleasure Island.
Pleasure Island.
Yeah, it reminded me of that because... Because Buscemi's character and McGregor are both kind of the only two that are not, like, born in the town. So it's very much so reminiscent of, like...
Don't eat the pie.
The pie. And that's where I got... That's where the Lotus Eater really... The Lotus Eaters really made sense. It's like, it's in the pie.
Yeah.
No, that whole scene was very, very interesting.
So I will say, going back to a second, the whole thing... I was confused with the whole siren thing. At how unimportant it was. Like, I don't know. Like, I was confused that it never came back around, really.
Well, it did.
It came back around the second time, but again, it was just something where he saw it, and then that was it.
The way that I saw it is those are the moments where, okay, so it's really convoluted. Let me see if I can say it in a way that's going to make sense. But this is the way that I sort of made sense of the siren in my head. Is that, again, death is trying to catch him through his entire life. And that fish is sort of like, you know, the way that he actually ends, as Will says, is that, you know, he drops into the river and swims off as that giant catfish. And so when he sees that woman who is that fish, you know, they're like, oh, it appears, you know, to different people as different things. You know, it's trying to draw him out into that water, into the river where, you know, he quote unquote dies.
And also, like, you can think about it, it appears as like what he wants, but don't take it in the way that he wants like a naked woman in the river. Like, what he wants is to be that fish in the river, like the big fish in the pond, you know.
I think of it more because oftentimes, and I could be wrong, but a lot of time women, I think, I don't know if it was in Greek mythos or what, but women often are used as like a symbolization of life and fertility. And I just took it as a way of this man's just pursuing life. I mean, it's just...
Alternatively, very like here's Dionysian. Another theory that I just kind of thought of that I don't know if this makes any sense or not. But both times the siren shows up is right before a decision that he has to make that could... majorly derail his life if he takes it in a different way.
The
first time is right before he has to decide to stay in Scepter or not.
Scepter.
I realized that I was saying, I was like, that's not right. and then the second time is right before the whole Ginny thing.
Because it's the huge storm.
It's very interesting.
So both, it could also just be that representation of death trying to catch up to him in terms of
just him being derailed by technically a woman, because both times it is Jenny trying to, like, you know, either get him to stay or like hoping that, you know, she's going to be in love with him, but he knows that his life and his destiny is Sandra.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, so like he says to her, which before we leave the town of Spectre, there's another symbolic thing that I really liked. But you know, he says to her, like, yes, I'll come back. And, like, you know, he leaves his shoes behind and he goes on. And then the second time he's like, I'm sorry, but like, it is only her. There is nobody else. Like, it is only Sandra. And that's what she says at the end, is that she's like, you know, there was your mom, and then there was every other woman in his life. Like, there was no one who could ever be on the same par as her. So, like, it could also kind of be that, where, because, like, the symbol of the, you know, naked woman is just the sort of the temptation of leaving, you know, the path that you are meant to be on and to try this other adventure. So maybe that's why it was in the form of, like, you know, an attractive nude woman, was because it's like, you know, you could also do this path. And every time he was like, no, you know, I want to stay on the path I'm on.
And this is the, I think this is the last point I'll personally make, probably on the naked lady in the river for the siren. I think at that point it becomes a matter of your personal experiences up to that point, because, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about symbolism. It's not really set in stone.
Yeah, it's whatever you perceive because it to be.
I can see how you could interpret that as a way of potentially, like, a darker path or a path towards death. Because in a lot of instances, I mean, for instance, I want to say in many of the Marvel cinematic universes, death is portrayed as a female.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in the Deadpool series.
Mistress Death.
Yeah, it's painted as, ever heard the phrase, death is a cruel mistress?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you could take it either way. I mean, I took it as a way of life. I mean, Sam probably saw it as a way of, you know, a darker path.
Yeah.
I think at that point, it's a very
open to interpretation.
Yeah,
it's very poetic.
Yeah,
okay. And I think that's kind of the beauty of this film, is there's a mix of prose and poetry, and I love it. Mm-hmm.
So
I knew you had something to say.
this is probably the place where I can spill the beans about the fates. So I said earlier there are three fates, but we only saw one. There are two other incarnations of that witch. There's little girl Jenny,
and then there's
older Jennifer. And we see, like, with this instance of both instances of the lady in the river and all that stuff, there's the major life decision. Well, both Jennies are trying to steer Ed towards this way. Like, this is the path that we have laid out for you. But Ed, being the guy that he is, the anti-mythological guy, says, no, screw you, fates. I'm going to make my decision.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my interpretation of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I gotcha. I think that's very... When you said there were three fates, I was like, it's going to be the other two. The other two Jennies, for sure.
That's confirmed later whenever they say that. They say she grew up to become a witch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then he's like, wait, that doesn't make sense because, like, you were old when he was young. And I love that
line where she was all like, yeah, but he only sees two women in his life. Sandra and everybody else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a great line. I was like, that really does explain, like, you know, just sort of his absolute devotion to Sandra. Yeah. But the thing, Inspector, that got me was the shoes and the feet, because, like, a whole thing with just symbology in general, because in high school I was, like, way too convoluted with creative writing and finding symbolism and things. I was always the one that was like, in class, I'd be like, well, what if he's actually dying? And they would be like, and my teacher would be like, no, he's literally not dying. And I'd be like, but I have all this proof. Right. And he's like, you're an idiot. And I'm like, okay. So I would just, like, stop trying with my stuff. But so the thing with the feet got me because in a lot of different, you know, symbolistic breakdowns, your feet represent your past. It's where you've been. And so when he leaves his shoes behind and she's like, well, what about your shoes? Like, you know, how are you going to get out of here without them? He's like, well, it'll probably hurt, but, you know, I'm going to go. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, that's straight up just him leaving his, like, whole, you know, past and possibility of life that he could have had in Spectre behind and going to pursue, you know, the destiny that he wants, like, and specifically being like, yeah, I'm going to leave all of that. And it's just, like, so representative of, you know, having to leave behind, you know, a comforting place where basically stepping out of your comfort zone because of your own ambition. And so it's like, you know, when you leave home to, you know, go to a different city or state or country to pursue a career or to pursue a relationship or to pursue just adventure, and you're leaving behind that comfort, it's like you're just leaving behind your shoes and you're going barefoot into this world to get these new experiences.
I got you. Yeah.
I meant to talk about this earlier whenever you first encountered the witch, but I freaking died laughing. Because there's one line, and the five kids, because he's telling the story about the first time he encountered the witch, And the five kids are walking up, and I'll never forget it. It stuck out so much. One kid goes, I don't remember which kid it was, but one kid goes, your mama's a gypsy. And then the other kid retorts with, yeah, and your mama's a bitch.
Yes, I did hear that.
So, did y'all catch? Yeah.
Baby Miley Cyrus.
Yeah, baby Miley Cyrus.
He did not catch it.
Did you see
it?
Baby
Miley there.
Cyrus?
I didn't.
That
Pre
was
Hannah Montana,
she was
like
little
8
Ruthie.
Years old.
Yes.
Was she?
Miley Cyrus.
I sat there and looked up and I went, that's Miley Cyrus. She, and Sam goes, no, it's not. And I was like, look it up right now. And he was like, oh my God, it is Miley Cyrus.
She was the one who was like, y'all shouldn't curse women present.
Yeah, that was
baby Miley Cyrus.
Because I was just...
That was a few years before Hannah Montana started.
Because I'm sitting there, you know, I'm eating food after a long shift at work, and I'm sitting there, I'm starting to watch the film. I don't know what it was, but I just wasn't expecting...
Your mom's
like,
a bitch.
It was so out of left field, too, because it's like, you're like, no correlation. It's like, your mama's the gypsy, and yeah, your mama's a bitch.
It reminded me of, like, It Chapter One with, like, Richie.
Yeah.
It reminded me of something that Richie's character would have said. Well, yeah, your mama's a bitch. That's what it reminded me of.
But getting back to the town of Spectre.
Yes.
There's
so much to talk about with Spectre.
Yeah, I do want to say this one thing. Spectre, death, boom. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, 100%.
Yes.
The town name was eerily alluding enough. It's
reaching the end of the line because you don't, because no one leaves. It's like, that is essentially, this is your graveyard. Do you pick this as your graveyard? And he's like, no, no, I don't. But yeah, so.
Say it.
What? Frosty what? Said, I've got something.
What if? I don't know why, but I just have a theory of what if he had an early experience with cancer at a young age?
Thank you for saying that, John.
What if he had an earlier experience with cancer at a young age, and he was at death's door?
See, that's what I took it to mean the first time, but then I was like, I'm not so sure later on. I started second guessing.
Well, like I said, this was another one of his encounters with fates trying to keep him in Spectre in his final resting place. So I would suggest that, yes, that's true. Like he
had some kind of,
he had an early death experience. Like
whether
it was cancer or not,
maybe it was just some kind of illness. Maybe it was something else. The reason
why I thought it was an early experience with cancer is because, you know, or some sort of terminal illness, maybe, is because of what you said about the shoes. Potentially just, like, neglecting, like, it's like, I don't care what kind of old medical history I have, that's, you know, I'm not going to let that slow my walk of life down. And eventually, you know, he gets better. But, I mean, I don't know. It's very apparent to me that it was a close encounter with death. And what if it was cancer? Because cancer comes and, I mean, it comes and goes. Sometimes it goes away for good. Sometimes you have to get in later.
And especially with the time period it's in, you know, there's a chance that even if it wasn't cancer, even if it was just something like pneumonia, you know, like in the time period that it was in, it would have been really hard for him to just easily recover from it, you know?
Right.
Blood poisoning from the leeches, you know?
Yeah, blood poisoning from the leeches. It could have been any number of things, but I think that's really smart. I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah.
Sorry, I had that revelation.
No.
When we get it out there.
Yeah. We could literally talk, like, for 3 hours just about
Spectre. Yeah. So Edward and Carl reunite and visit the Calloway Circus, where Edward falls in love with a beautiful young woman. Carl and Edward get jobs in the circus, where the ringmaster Amos Calloway reveals to Edward one detail about the woman at the end of every month.
Yo, let's
which
just
seems very biblical to me.
Let's not ignore the fact that straight up Ed got a dude, like, freaking fired because of Carl.
I love the part where he just gets in the truck and he's like, okay.
Like, fine.
And what's even funnier is, like, I love the power that Ed has in his own stories that he tells his kid.
Yeah.
Like, he looks at a spotlight guy and goes, nah, dude, over here.
Hey, over here.
And, like, I got a bigger one. Like,
and I do want to say, like, just fun, interesting fact. Colosso was like only like 3 inches shorter than Carl.
Yeah, he wasn't that much shorter.
Which I like to mention again, Tim Burton camera angles are brilliant. Oh, also a fun fact about Carl. They had to custom make shoes for him using suitcases.
Yeah, like straight up out of luggage, they had to make his shoes.
Dude, that was
fantastic.
Because what was his shoe size? I have it in here. It was like 23 something. Oh, no. So when he was alive, he held the Guinness World Record for largest feet, U.S. size 29 and a half.
I will say, I kind of lost that Danny DeVito's assistant because I think the first time he came on screen, I just yelled, Oompa Loompa!
Oh, yeah. The guy that was his like little right-hand man was the guy who played all the Oompa Loompas in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
See, she was all like, oh, that's the Oompa Loompa from Willy Wonka. I was like, it is? And she was like, oh, Charlie and Chocolate Factory. I was like, oh.
He just goes, get out of here.
Samuel's very pretentious about his Willy Wonka.
Very much.
No, I just want to take a moment and recognize the awesome, like, the awesome, whatever film technique they used for the stopping time sequence. That looked brilliant, flawless, and just awesome.
It was really good. I liked it a lot. I kept looking for like anything that looked wrong, and all I could look at, and it wasn't even wrong, I just thought it was funny, was the frozen cat in midair behind him as he's walking towards her. I couldn't even look at him because the cat's just like all poofed out.
Cats are the perfect Easter eggs. Like, I love it. You watch the film another time and just count all the cats in there. Especially
so
with Jennifer's
cats.
House.
Yeah. Yes. Oh my goodness. I kept being like, oh, kitty. Oh, there's another one. Like, they were everywhere. But 3 years later, so Edward discovers that Amos is secretly a werewolf and is attacked by him, but avoids getting him shot with a silver bullet by playing fetch until he turns back into human in the morning.
Oh, werewolves. So
I kept thinking...
That was weird.
See, I thought he wasn't even a werewolf. I thought... I turned to Sam and went, it's the Grimm, because I saw, like, Animagus. But then I was like, he turns uncontrollably, so I guess he's a werewolf, but he looked like the Grimm. He looked like Sirius Black.
See, I took it, and it made sense because I didn't even think about mythos, but whenever you mentioned mythos, I was trying to make sense of the whole, what was it? His name was Calloway?
Calloway,
okay. Yeah. And I thought of it as, you know, I thought it was an homage to Norse mythos with Loki and Fenrir.
Mm-hmm.
It could be. I didn't find anything about Greek mythology having to do with it.
Yeah, I thought I just took it as...
Well, yeah.
I just took it as werewolf.
Yeah.
The way that I took it was that, like, back to the whole, like, framing of the story. Like, this, like, he's telling this to a kid. This is his way of saying, hey, don't judge a book by its cover. Like, some things may look scary and mean.
Yeah.
But that's just because they're lonely and they need, you know, to play fetch sometimes.
Yeah. I did see some parallels also with specifically that, with like the trials of Hercules and everything, with all the beasts that he had to like conquer, except instead of killing it,
had his head in a lion.
Yeah. He's straight up like holding his head inside a lion. He's having all these things. And I was like, oh, it's like the trials of Hercules. And then when he fights, like,
gotta love that up close puppet work.
Oh yeah. Very up close, big lion's head. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, yeah, that was good.
That's another thing. It's a story.
It's just a story. But yeah, so Amos, upon returning to normal, reveals the woman's name to be Sandra Templeton and that she attends Auburn University. So Edward goes to Auburn via cannon and stalks Sandra for many days, even going so far as to plant thousands of daffodils outside her dorm bedroom. I remember I was like, this is like kind of sweet what he's doing, but also he just followed her like a long way, appeared at her door with her favorite flowers and was like, I'm in love with you. I was like, nowadays?
It was a lot sweeter back in the 50s.
Yeah, I was about to say, nowadays, like, you would get an instant restraining order and be like, get away from me.
I know we don't get a lot of insight to Don's character and we just take Ed's word for it. But
you're talking about Roy?
Is it Don, Roy?
It's Don, but it's Roy from
The
Office.
It's Roy from The Office.
Yeah. But Don, like, I feel Don is justified in every action of just throttling the ever-living crap out of Ed.
Absolutely. Like, honestly.
Literally, Don's entire life is screwed over because of Ed.
But
and
also,
he literally dies because of Ed.
But also,
so,
it's
according
because
to the story,
his own rage and, like, bitterness and inability to just create his own like path for himself outside of like Edward and succeed in something like in a totally different path, that's the downfall of him. Because,
I don't know,
like,
could because Edward finally left, and then apparently Dom was doing pretty good for himself.
Yeah.
Because he'd gotten engaged. But then he'd gotten all this stuff, and then he comes back. Honestly, if you have somebody who you're overshadowed by your whole life, and then they leave, and finally you're able to actually have your own life free of this influence, and then you go visit your fiance, and he's there wooing her.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're going to beat the crap out of him.
No, like, but here's my thing.
I'm firmly on Dom's side.
I saw it from her side because I'm like, she has only known these two guys in this light. And so she's like, yeah, okay, you know, this guy is really sweet. But until she saw the rage inside of Dom, mm-hmm. she wasn't really planning to break off the engagement. It was yeah. just him doing all of that and like trying to kill Ed. That she was like, yeah, I'm not going to marry you. And honestly, I think if Dawn had come back and just taken the high road mm. And like tried to swallow some of that old bitterness and been like, look, she cares about me. She said yes. You know, I want to like be, you know, I'm just going to be the bigger person. I've started to succeed without this guy here. Let me just like chill.
I don't know.
But clearly he hadn't resolved it.
I'm firmly.
Well, he did the one thing that you 100% never ever do. And this is whenever I went like, fully against Dawn forever. He did the one, like, this is what he did. He said the words, she's mine.
Yeah, that's the problem is that,
yeah.
is because then she realized if I choose to stay with him now, then, like, he has just said that he owns me.
But, well, but again, view it from Dawn's perspective. He's talking to Edward at that point, this guy who has basically taken everything from him.
Yeah.
And so he's viewing it as no... This is part of my life that you can't take from me.
Well, here's the thing.
Like, this is mine. This relationship is mine. She is mine. You can't take this from me. I don't know. I'm so undone.
Well, here's the lesson. The lesson that he was trying to be told with that is you cannot let, you know, you can't let comparing yourself to someone else take over your entire life.
Yeah.
Because if you do, you're gonna end up, you know, sad. You're gonna end up not achieving what you could achieve if you just went on your own and made your own path instead of constantly comparing yourself, constantly being like, he's better than me at everything. It's like, okay, well, like, just move somewhere else. Do something different with your life if he is overshadowing you mm-hmm. and ruining right. your life that much. So when he leaves, great, he starts doing that, but then he lets himself start comparing himself again the second he sees him.
Yeah, but I just want to say that keep in mind this is a story. For all we know, Dawn may not have actually been real. Like,
that's
in,
fair.
In this context. Like, I mean, he may have been real. He may not have, like, had... or reacted in that way. He may not have had the kind of life that we see him as having.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, like, every good story, like, you need an adversary, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
So his adversary was Dawn.
Mm-hmm.
And vice versa.
I will say, though, nothing is funnier to me than seeing Ewan McGregor put on that big old smile and just get... punch to just
oh my gosh
that should be his headshot for like every
it's
audition
just
that
mouthful
he goes
in. Of blood like oh my goodness but yeah she tells him that she's engaged to Edward's childhood peer Dawn and then Dawn beats up Edward prompting Sandra to break off their engagement and marry Edward. Not long after Dawn soon dies of a heart attack on the toilet as the witch had prophesied. And shortly after, Edward is drafted into the army and sent to fight in the Korean War. He parachutes into the middle of a North Korean military show, steals important documents, and convinces Siamese twins Ping and Jing to help him go home in exchange for making them celebrities.
So this is, like, just an interesting fact to kind of solidify the whole thing of we are seeing this as a formation of inside the person's imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So, they're not always speaking Korean. Like, there's language jumps. So, basically, this is like, you're telling kids a story, like, and you maybe say some words in Korean to, like, make them, like, understand the context. But then they hear, like, just similar words in their head. Like, it's like, okay, well, here's kind of what it sounds like whenever they're talking. So, which is why, like, there's some language jumps. And who knows?
Yeah.
It may be more of a practical reason. Like, we all, like, there were Chinese and Japanese people fighting in the Korean War as well. So,
So, it's not completely just out
of the field. Also, if it was something that the audience would understand, there would have been subtitles. there was no subtitles in the film.
But it, yeah, because you weren't meant to, like, understand exactly what they were saying. Yeah.
Well, and I liked that his little book was American to Asian.
Yes, it wasn't a specific language. It was just English to Asian.
Well, no, it was American to Asian.
No, it said English.
I'm pretty sure it said American.
I'm, like, positive. You know what? Look it up.
I will.
Look it up.
Do it. Here's a little interesting fact. Just while I'm here, the ventriloquist, or Tim Burton, now has the ventriloquist dummy in his office.
He saved it. Yeah. I think he said that he named it like either Ling or Lang. It was one of those.
I think it's Ling.
Yeah, he kept it and just like named it.
Here's an idea. What if I'm imagining all this being in the perspective or mind of young Will, like.
Well, it's in the perspective or mind of whoever is hearing the story. So yeah. Sometimes it's Josephine.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like with, what was it this story that he's telling Josephine? Yeah,
I think it was this story.
He's telling
yeah.
Josephine this story.
Because when she goes and like gets in bed with Will, she's like, why didn't you tell me how your parents met? And he's like, I did. And she's like, no, like with the circus and with the war. And he's like, because it didn't happen.
Which I just want to add. Josephine and Edward's like
dynamic.
It's so awesome.
I love it so much. It's such a sweet dynamic. It's just like,
did you catch who she was, Joan?
She looked familiar, but I never could place it.
She was Miranda Tate, Ra's al Ghul's daughter in Dark Knight Rises.
I told Sam I just thought she looked like Daenerys from Game of Thrones had a baby with Mila Kunis, and that's what she looked like to me.
That's another thing. This film like just had a bunch of like Oscar people. Like she won an Very Oscar. Good. Jessica Lange,
huge actors, and just like beautiful actors. Like there were a lot. Wonderful.
Yeah, but what I wanted to say was is that what if, because you're familiar with the phrase "joint at the hip," right?
Yeah.
So what if, just because of wording alone, this is why I think it's like, you know, like a young Will perspective. What if in describing these identical twins, he was like, they're joined at the hip.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. He had never even meant it to say.
Wonderful.
That's incredible.
I'm jumping for joy right now.
Like, because at the end of the film, you realize that they're not at all like.
Yeah.
Because for the most part, everyone in that ending scene, like, is verbatim exactly how they were
except
in the story.
Except for Carl and the twins.
Yep, Carl, exactly.
Which, again, Carl, he could have described him as, you know, a giant.
And so, therefore,
Will was all like, 10 feet tall. When in reality, I mean, yeah, he's huge, but like.
He's like 7 foot something.
7'5" or
seven
something.
7'6", I think.
Yeah. Oh, okay, But
which
yeah.
is tall.
Which is
yes,
very
he's
tall.
Very, very tall. Let's not pretend he's tall.
But I just love, like, movies, plays, whatever, like that, where the story is told by an unreliable storyteller.
Yep.
Like, I mean,
yes.
like The Glass Menagerie, Tennessee Williams.
Joker.
Like, it's the best thing ever.
Yeah. No, it's great. But upon returning home, Edward becomes a traveling salesman and crosses paths with Winslow. He unwittingly helps Winslow rob a failing bank with no money and later inspires the poet to work on Wall Street. And Winslow becomes a wealthy broker and repays Edward with $10,000, which Edward uses to obtain his dream house. I just love the whole thing of like, he's like, I'm so sorry, I just don't want anyone to get hurt. And she's like, no, it's not that. We're broke. We don't have anything in here.
Like, even then, it's like, don't tell anybody.
Yeah, don't tell anyone.
She's more concerned about the reputation of the bank being.
Well, because I mean, that's how, you know, that's how the Great Depression happened, is everybody realized, the banks have no money.
So here's the context of that actual story. In my mind, at least, like, I mean, Ed and his wife were probably like having a discussion about like they're having financial issues. They're like probably maybe raising voices and stuff. And like Lil Will comes in, he's like, oh, what's going on? And this is Edward's way of saying, hey, like, let me tell you this story. Like, so banks have no money.
Yeah.
And it's because of these people.
So if you try to rob a bank, there's not actually going to be money. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So if you want to get money, go to Wall Street. Do all this awesome stuff.
Yeah. Where he's like, you know, basically just don't assume that the banks have money because you'll be wrong.
It's wonderful.
Yes. So in the present, Will investigates the truth behind his father's tales and travels to Spectre. He meets an older Jenny who explains that Edward rescued the town from bankruptcy by buying it in an auction and rebuilt it with help from his friends with the Calloway Circus. Will suggests that Jenny had an affair with his father, but she reveals that although she loved Edward, he remained loyal to Sandra.
Mm-hmm. That's another thing of, like, once again, one of the fates, and, like, you even solidify even more whenever Ed's, like, saying, oh, nothing's gonna change, I'm just gonna own the house. And then she said, well, if nothing's gonna change, I'd rather them not change.
Yeah, exactly.
Straight line of fate. And oh, and also I just want to throw out the fact that Helena Bonham Carter was pregnant during this
she
movie.
Was yeah.
Yeah, she definitely was a little
yeah,
so she's just the beast that she is.
I just love Helena Bonham Carter so much. She is so talented and just so amazing at everything she does. I love it so much.
Yeah, dude.
But Will returns home, but learns Edward has had a stroke and stays with him at the hospital. Edward wakes up, but unable to speak much, asks Will to narrate how his life ends. Though struggling, Will tells his father of their imagined daring escape from the hospital to the nearby river, where everyone from Edward's past is there to see him off. Will takes Edward into the river, where Edward transforms into the giant catfish and swims away.
That's CGI.
Oh, yeah. That's 2003 CGI right 2003. There.
It's okay.
But yeah, a satisfied Edward dies, knowing Will finally understands his love for storytelling.
It's one of those things where, like, it's not just, it's more than, like, because we know Will didn't find out, like, the whole truth about, like, his father in that
right,
moment. Like, he finds out later on, of course, at the funeral, but, like, he doesn't find out the whole truth about his father, but he's okay with that. Because this is, like, he's understanding why the story is meant so much. Which is why, spoiler alert, the book actually ends on this scene. Like, it ends with this story, and it's saying, like, oh, there's a legend of this big fish that lives in the pond. Some people believe it, but a bunch of people don't, but it still lives on, you know?
Yeah. And sort of like we talked about in Prestige, I think this also is just about, you know, creating a different reality for yourself and the people around you. You know, like, especially for your kids and your grandkids, it's like, you know, you want to create this world in which, you know, everything is possible and, like, you know, magic can happen and, like, these great adventures can occur. So, like, we want to, you know, encourage their imagination and their ambition and their drive to, like, you know, keep trying for these, you know, amazing moments in life, because amazing moments can happen. They just may not happen all the time.
Yeah, I think the major there's a lot of morals that are brought up in this story. I think the major one is life is an adventure with a series of stories, and while you may not be here long, your stories will continue forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, like, that's why this movie resonated so much with me, because, like, my family has a bunch of, like, those crazy legends and everything. Like, Daniel, I'm pretty sure you remember my story, my legend of the submarine fish.
Oh, yes, I do remember.
Like, we have a big fish story. We have a story of, like, a copperhead chasing my Papa Bill down Little Kennesaw Mountain. We have, like, different stories. See, like that.
My family's story is just that we're somehow related to Jesse James. There's a whole conspiracy theory there. Yeah.
I don't think my family has any, like, mythological legends. Yeah. My family's just like, yeah, so one time my granddad farted in church and blamed it on my grandma and everybody. And that's, like, the story of my family.
as to quote Edward Bloom, story of my life.
Yes.
Which I just want to say that little exchange right there whenever, like, Will's telling the story and he's like, it's impossible. It's indescribable. And Ed's just like, story of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's where I tear up every time.
That scene teared me, like, had me tearing up a lot.
That ending sequence definitely got me teared up.
Because the actor playing Will just really, like, nailed it, like, having to think of all this on the spot, but making it the exact perfect ending to his dad's story. But when there's been all this resentment, and, like, you see on, like, his dad's face just this, like, joy, and he's, like, and he's with him. Like, the whole time he's like, yes, that's the end of the story. Like, that's perfect.
He was literally such a fantastic actor in the story, and he's not even, like, a big name actor, and it was, like, in this movie, it was, like, every time it was in real life, it felt real because of his interactions mm-hmm. with his father, because of the awkwardness of he couldn't make eye contact whenever he's talking to him because of all this history.
Like, the first time he makes genuine, real eye contact with him is when he's dying, and he makes consistent eye contact with him. And he's like, it's almost like he's feeding the story, like, from his mind into Edward's, like, I'm going to help you live this as your last moments. Yes. Like, this
and
is
like,
going to be it.
And that, you know, like, looking from the character's point of view, it's that's hard. Because, like, this resentment for, we don't really know how long.
3 years.
3 years?
Since the wedding.
Since the wedding, we don't know how long since he realized.
We just know that it was longer than he would have liked.
This resentment, and, you know, like, just coming back to, for his father's back into the illness, and sit there, his father is on death's door, and instead of sitting there, because, I mean, we see that hesitancy of, like, you know, he wants to get the nurse, wants to get a doctor.
He wants to call his mom, but he's like, no, I know what you want, and I'm going to give you what you want in your final moments.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is just you and me living the story that you always wanted to.
It's quite literally telling the last story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Telling the last story.
And I bet Ed didn't even have a story of, like, how it ends or anything. Like, he didn't have an answer for what he saw.
He just knew how he didn't want it to happen.
Yeah.
Yes.
He just knew that he, like, didn't want to be alone, didn't want it to just be, like...
To go out quietly, you know?
Yeah, he didn't want to, like, go out dying, like, if that makes any sense. He wanted to go out living, you know?
Yeah, do not go gently into that good night, you know, like that, where he's like, no, I want to go out with a bang. Like, you know, whatever it is, I want it to be a big spectacle and it's got to be great. But yeah, so at the funeral, Will and Josephine are surprised when all the people from Edward's stories come to the service, though each one is a slightly less fantastical version than described. Will, finally understanding his father's love for life, passes on Edward's stories to his own son.
Thus he becomes immortal.
Yes. Yep. And that was Big Fish, guys. So, if you could rename this movie anything else, what would you retitle this one?
The Extraordinary Life of Edward Bloom.
All right.
I had one before I came, and then I forgot.
Should have run it down.
I think maybe I would just call it something like The Fabulous Fallacy.
I would call it just simply How It Happens.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Tell me how it happens. Okay. I think that's good.
That's
yeah.
good. Yeah.
What about you, John?
Oh, geez. Dramatic movies are way harder.
They are harder to rename, for sure.
I mean, it's so well done. It's tacky, and I hate it. The story of my life.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
Okay. That would work.
All right, so time for the guessing game. So Sam can't play the first part, because when we pulled it up on Vudu last night, the Rotten Tomatoes critical score popped right up. So Sam knows, so it's just you guys.
Well,
so, did you already look at it?
Well, I did, but I kind of probably forgot it.
Okay. So I'll still let you play if you don't totally remember.
I'll let John go first.
Yes, John, you get to go first. So the critical score.
Critical score.
Yes.
And that's out of 100.
Out of 100, okay. Yes.
Yeah,
Sam can play on the audience score, but he can't play on this one.
I don't think they would have scored it super high, but it wasn't low either, I don't think. I'm gonna go with 88.
Okay.
So if I remember correctly, it's actually very surprising at 75.
It is 75. Yep, that is correct.
Very surprising.
Yes, and then what about the audience score? So Sam, you can play now.
I'm going to say audience score is actually going to be a little lower, because audiences are a lot of times dumb and they don't like following convoluted stuff. I'm going to say about 71 for the audience score.
Okay, John?
Doing it for the meme, 69.
Okay.
So, again, if I remember it correctly, it's actually higher, 81.
You're closer, but it's not 81. It's actually 89. Really good audience score. And then the IMDb score is out of 10.
I'm going to go with that kind of balance, I'm going to go with 8.2.
I'm going to say 7.6.
Okay.
I think it was 8.0. Just straight
ahead. It was 8.0. Okay. Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And so the budget
He said he forgot.
I may have a good memory. I don't remember
it's
if I have
okay,
a good
John,
memory.
Because he had seen them previously, I am counting your answers, John, as the actual guesses.
Yeah.
Yes. I was mostly letting you keep track of all these,
so at the end of the year we can like give out stats of like who guessed what.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm the guest here. I mean, I win. Okay.
He automatically wins the game.
Whatever.
So this movie had a budget of $70 million, and it made $122.9 million.
Okay, not bad.
Nice.
And then, so I went on Amazon. So the general consensus by viewers is pretty good. It's an 85% 5-star rating. Do y'all want to hear positive or negative first?
I always like hearing positive first, but that's just negative.
Positive
first.
Because
we have 2 out of 3 saying positive. We're going.
I say positive because I want to give some words to the negative.
Yeah, so let's go positive first. So positive. This is a 5-star review from Mark B, and it's titled "It's a blow pop lollipop of a movie." So here we go.
Not wrong.
Years ago, when I first watched this movie, I felt really entertained. Felt the movie odd at times or hard to grasp in certain scenes, but I watched it again, then later again and again and again. This movie was like eating a blow pop. You keep coming back for more, and then wow, you sense the center of it all. I'm a guy, and I still cry at certain points, as it reminds me of my dad that passed on and the relationship we had in ways that seem to parallel the movie's life story. Top 10 best movies I've ever seen. Funny, my wife has watched it, appreciates the content and acting, but does not get the thrill I get every time I watch it. In my opinion, you don't have to be a son or father to understand or truly feel the deep humanistic aspects of this movie. Like a blow pop, it's the ending that blows you away. 5 stars.
Okay.
Nice. I like it, but I wouldn't put it in my top 10. Like, drama-wise, it's at least like top 20 for sure. But
that's fair.
Not top 10. I wouldn't put it in top 10 for me.
Well, now we got some negatives. So these are both pretty short, so I'm going to read them both. So the first one is no spaces or capitals or punctuation. It's just don't ask me questions unless you want the truth. And then it's titled sappy, boring, sorry imitation, southern accents. And then it says, what's to like other than it's a children's bedtime story? Finney was especially boring to listen to. And Bloom, well, he should have hung out in a few Alabama small towns so that he could get the accent right before stepping in front of a camera with the audio channel turned on.
Okay, so not completely wrong about that. I love Ewan McGregor. I absolutely love
accent
Ewan
was
McGregor.
Rough.
He's one of my
it's
favorite
in a story.
Actors.
It's in
and
a story.
And I told them, you know, there were some parts of the movie where he did a good job.
Yeah.
And I think those were probably scenes that they filmed later.
Yeah.
And like he was getting better as they go along, but especially some of the narration was
no,
really,
I told Sam at one point,
really
I was like, and
rough.
I told him, I was like, I can't tell if I'm getting used to the movie or if his accent is getting better.
Also,
like,
he almost went to Texas at parts and mm-hmm. like,
yeah.
Cause like,
but keep in mind, he did live in Texas for a little bit, like doing travel and sales.
Yeah,
and stuff.
That's
so,
true.
That's
yeah.
true. But,
so I guess that makes sense.
My whole family's from South Alabama. So like, mm-hmm. I'm very familiar with that accent. And it was really rough at some parts. Some parts it was fine, and
yeah.
some parts it was rough. But I loved Albert Finney as
me
like,
too.
It was weird because I actually thought the casting of the two of them was a weird pairing because I couldn't see the connection very well. But I loved each of them in their respective mm-hmm. roles.
So there's a reason for that casting.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
looked at a picture of like Albert Finney younger,
yeah.
and it looked exactly like
Ewan McGregor.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. That's why they did that. Yeah. But the other one
I mean, I'm
is
not mad about it, 'cause I love you.
Yeah, yeah.
The other one is from a user called Wabbit, and it's titled "Too Much Senseless and Wabbit. Illogical Virtue Signaling for Absolutely No Reason."
Virtue signaling.
Well, it says waited and waited for some kind of a meaningful revelation about the man, and it was all nothing but fluff until the very end. The supposedly made up stories were actually more believable. 1 star.
Gosh, that person okay. better not read the book then.
Yeah, if they're that bitter about what's happening right
well,
now.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, because there's like another spoiler for the book. Go read the book. But like I said, it ends on that note, but there's no like revelations or anything. Like we don't get an answer whether the stories are true or not. We like there's no like reconciliation that much other than like there's this nice moment while his dad's dying. But that's mm-hmm. about it. Like,
yeah.
you don't have a resolution
it's
because
it's never
immortal.
Been, it never was about the stories being true. It was
yeah.
about the mm-hmm. essence that the story created.
Yeah, it was mm-hmm. about, it wasn't about the stories being true. It was about the fact that there were stories.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I agree. So there are some fun facts. You've hit on a few of them, but there are some I have here that have not been touched on. So first up,
I have some extra ones.
Okay, cool. Well, so the joke with the elephant, elephant just like taking a crap while Edward is daydreaming was completely unscripted. The filming crew just thought it was really funny, and so they zoomed out to get the entire thing really quick.
Yeah.
And then the witch's makeup took about 5 hours to actually apply. Which isn't surprising because it looked really, really good.
Yeah.
And yeah, so the actual languages that are all spoken when he lands in Korea is, so the ventriloquist and his puppet are speaking Tagalog, which is the language of the Philippines. And then the Siamese twins and Edward speak in Cantonese. And then the soldiers who pull the ventriloquist off stage are speaking Mandarin, while all the other soldiers are speaking Korean. So that's the actual, like, breakdown
that's
of who's doing what.
That's a whole menagerie.
Yes.
I mean, hey, it's American Asian, so.
Yes, exactly.
American Asian.
So another thing is that 3 years is a prominent and, like, consistent amount of time that appears in the film on multiple occasions.
The
so, like, there's, you know, Will and his father not talking to each other for 3 years. Edward mentioning that he had to stay in his bed for 3 years during his growth spurt. He worked for Calloway Circus for 3 years. And he mentioned that he had to stay in the army for 3 years.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So all of that, again, there's so many things with the rule of three, with like, you know, the Trinity with the three fates, you know, there's so many things like that you could say about three. While Spectre is a fictional town, the zip code that is shown on the deed to Jenny's house is actually real. 36104 is one of the zip codes for Montgomery, Alabama. And you can, however, Google the town of Spectre and see the private island where the set is now abandoned.
Oh, that
field trip.
Creepy.
Yeah. So field trip.
That is, oh, that's creepy.
So those are the ones I had. Did you have anything else, Adam?
So in the opening sequence, we didn't really talk much about that, but this kind of solidifies the whole thing of Death trying to catch up to Ed.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the lures, I mean, it could also be because he was talking about like the ghost of a drowned sailor or something. But one of the lures turns and you see like a reflection of a skull in the lure.
Oh, that's cool.
So that's like,
it's a thief is what you're talking about. I remember now.
Yeah, the thief. It could be an example of that, or it could be like, you know, that's Death's lure trying to catch.
Right.
Yeah.
Ed. I just want to bring some attention to the whole daddy gonna die story.
Which one?
Oh,
that one. That was funny.
The one
with it where it turns out to be the milkman who drops dead.
Yeah,
that was so
classic
funny.
Dad joke.
I
loved
say that's
it.
The best. Oh,
that
but
was
also.
Great.
So the economics teacher in Auburn was this guy who wrote the book, Daniel Wallace.
Yeah.
He was the economics teacher who put on the slide, I love Sandra Templeton.
Which, perfect. When that came up, I was like, so is this not going to cause like problems in the college?
Oh, yeah, he got fired.
Oh, 100%. He so got fired because everyone was like, you just professed your love to a student. And it's like, no, it wasn't me. I promise. The whole time I was like, oh, man, that poor guy just lost his job. So if we're going to recast each other in Big Fish.
Well, John's Danny DeVito.
100%. You're Danny DeVito.
Yes.
That's
yes.
Just...
Anything with Danny DeVito. I am.
I
saw that character. Because I'm sitting there. Naturally, I'm sitting there thinking, all right, how are we going to cast this? And I'm like, God, Danny DeVito's in this.
once Danny DeVito comes out with like a documentary about his life, you're gonna play him.
Yes, you will be playing Danny DeVito in his remake of the story of his life.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Sam, I think you are either Will Bloom or you're Steve Buscemi's character. Those are the two I can see you playing.
He's Buscemi.
Danielle's Miley Cyrus.
Get out of here with your crap.
Yeah, don't kiss. There's ladies present.
Get out of here.
I think Danielle's Ginny.
Yeah, probably. Probably Ginny.
I
was about to say little kid Ginny or grown up
Ginny.
Tell
people shoes throwing them on the line.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
No, I was going to say grown. I think you could play grown up Ginny. I don't think
I'm one of the unique body types where I can play either.
Yeah, like truly.
Or both.
Or both. Put me in pigtails for one and then just normal hair for the other. And we're like, cool, I'm 6 and then I'm 25.
Which is probably may have been what they did with the staged musical. I can't remember.
Is there a musical of this?
Yes, that was actually the first thing that I saw of it. And then I
I'm thinking of a totally different thing. For a second, I was like, oh, I've heard of that. No, I've heard of Big River, not Big Fish. Those are two very different things.
Yeah. Anyway, what would I play?
Oh, that's good question. That's what I was thinking
of. Know what? If he's Buscemi, you would be Bloom.
Yeah, young.
Will Bloom?
Bloom or?
I think.
Will Bloom or Edward Bloom?
Oh, good question. You know what?
I'd play the fish.
So there's two very different things with Bloom I could see you playing. I could see you playing grown Will Bloom, or I could see you playing Edward Bloom as a kid, like when he's seeing the witch for the first time. When he's like, I want to see, and then he's like, oh, that's how I go.
I don't know if you mind, ma'am, but I'd like to see your eye.
Yeah, I could see you in both of those. Yeah.
I will say that, like, I didn't realize it until, like, looking at him, but, like, if we were to, like, and I know we would never... But if we were to remake Andy Griffith, Ewan McGregor would play a fantastic older Opie.
Okay.
Oh yes.
Here's what I said. I did not realize this until I watched this movie, and I've seen him in other stuff, but I don't know why it didn't click until I watched this movie. It must have been the accent. Steve Buscemi could play Don Knotts.
100%.
Like I don't know how I hadn't realized it before, but I was like. Yeah. He could straight up play Don Knotts. He
literally looks exactly like him in a way. Like,
yep. Like he's a little taller than him, but like his acting is very similar. Mm-hmm. His acting style. Oh like he looks
just,
like
just imagining him in a remake of The Ghost of Mr. Chicken.
Oh, yeah.
But also you know who could play a grown up Opie Taylor? Ron Howard.
True. How old is Ron Howard?
He's like 50. He's like 50 something. 50 I mean, or 60.
He's kind of gotten out of the acting stuff. He's more directing
he's
a director now.
Yeah. That's I definitely fair. Know he's been doing directing.
Because you know,
he would direct the show.
Yeah, he would direct it.
I don't know if you ever actually watched Da Vinci Code. I know you.
No,
like
but
the
I've
books.
Read the book.
I know you like the book. He directed the movie.
I know I need to watch the movie because isn't Tom Hanks, Robert Langdon in that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. So and I love Tom Hanks,
and
so I need to watch it.
Directed by Opie Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. It's see, I've read
movie.
All of the Robert Langdon books because I love them, but I haven't seen any.
I have all of them. I haven't read them yet.
Oh, I've read all of them. I think they're Lost Symbol, if you haven't read that one, is the best one I've read besides Da Vinci Code. So highly recommend. So now for Sam's favorite question, favorite and least favorite moments. I was thinking about this during the movie, so I am ready to go. I don't have a least favorite off the top of my head, but I had multiple favorites being the conversation, talking about the iceberg conversation between Will and Edward.
It was so authentic.
I loved it. It was beautiful. The scene between Helena Bonham Carter and Will, when she's like just being very upfront and honest with him about everything. And she's, you know, saying the line about like, there's only two women in his life. And then of course the ending, like where his whole, like his death story. Those are my three favorites.
I mean, I just want to say, I like all of the scenes that were in real life because of just, it was all authentic and everything.
Very
but
well
like
done.
My number one scene that like, it always makes me cry because it's just the best scene ever is the How It Happened scene where he's just telling the story. Like it's. Like, I've been in, like, situations like that where you're with, like, an older relative who's dying and you're like, I don't know what to do.
Right. Yeah. Like, I don't know what to do in this situation.
Like it's like, do I push this button? Do I go get someone or do I just, like...
Am I just supposed to be with this person?
Yeah. 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 And then, like, I mean, I guess number two would be, like, I always get chills whenever I start seeing the fictional characters in the real life scenarios.
At the funeral?
End.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like... Once I see the Bigfoot step out of the car, I'm like, ooh, it's happening.
Here they come. I don't know what my least favorite would have been.
I'm going to start with my least favorite. It was, oh, good Lord, I lost it. It was there.
Oh, I actually do know what it was, but it was just a snippet. It wasn't even a full scene. It was just, the actress inspector who plays like the wife of the main guy, she's so good at looking so scary and creepy.
Gosh, she's terrifying.
And so when she's like, you're quite a catch, and it just lingers on her smile for a minute, it was creepy and I loved it, but at the same time I was like, get away from me.
just that whole sequence whenever they're dancing and it's just like, and then Steve Buscemi's just like, hey,
dude, I love that.
He's
like
so tagging along.
He's just trying
Steve
to
Steve Buscemi is
I will so say great. Just as a whole, I just didn't. It may just because me, it's Tim Burton, but I didn't like how creepy Spectre was.
See, I love the creepiness. It was just that one moment where I was like, okay.
Like, I just didn't like how, like, it was like, just like the deadpan smile and just like everyone rocking in a row. I'm like, yeah, this needs to stop. I didn't ask for a horror film.
So I love that. Mm-hmm. My least favorite moment would be the song, the conjoined twin song.
Oh yeah, he did not like that.
I was so
like
uncomfortable
all.
With all of that. I
he actively like shuddered after it was over. He was like, I didn't like it.
And then my favorite moment would be any time Albert Finney was just telling stories. Mm-hmm. Just there is nothing better than sitting down with an older man or an older woman who has lots of life experience, especially when they have that southern accent, mm-hmm. especially for me, that Alabama accent, because it's the same accent that my grandfather has, mm-hmm. Had. So like just hearing a South Alabama accent telling stories, it's like I'm sitting there.
I would listen to anyone with that accent narrate like an audiobook or a podcast any day. I'd be like, this is just the most comforting.
It's
like,
so, yes. I mean, anytime.
Did I tell you about the legend of the submarine fish? back since the dawn before the dinosaurs, they lived this great fish.
Yeah. I will say my favorite scene was the bank robbing scene.
Yeah.
I mean, just it was great.
It was so a great scene.
Just because, I mean, poor Ed's just like, oh, it's nice to see you again.
What are you doing now?
He's like robbing the bank.
Also, quick side note, I was really hoping Obi-Wan had a comment for us. A review for us on Amazon.
I know, he didn't have one this time.
I mean, like, it's a Ewan McGregor film, man.
I know.
Come
on.
He
might be on there, but he wasn't the top reviewer, so I didn't pick his. But I will check and see if he had one, because there's a chance that he did.
Well, I do have a least favorite,
okay.
Which is surprising, because this film is perfect. But, I know I came to its defense, but I still just don't understand fully the whole werewolf scene.
That's
I'm
fair.
Like, why is it there? Like, I get we need to have the sex appeal of Danny DeVito naked, but I mean,
yeah.
Obviously, you can't have a good movie without.
Yo, that back pan up shot.
Oh yeah, just full on booty up, just like, oh, are they gonna show? Yep, that's a full Danny DeVito ass right there.
PG-13 nudity.
Oh yeah, this movie got as close as you can get, I think, to
PG-13.
To PG, like. I mean, they really bordered the line there with the siren.
Especially with her, like, swimming around.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it was just fuzzed out enough that, like, if it had been not fuzzed out any less, I don't think they could have gotten away with it.
Yeah, Sam turned to me after that scene, because I had been, I think I was, like, I was looking at something on my phone, or I was doing something, so I missed a little bit of her swimming around. And as she's swimming away, he goes, they literally just blurred it enough.
Yeah.
like just
it was
enough.
It's a little foggy in that.
I mean, like, you still, like, you saw everything. Like, it was fogged out, so it was just, like, hazy, but still, you saw everything. This is a PG-13 movie.
Yeah.
I was surprised they got away with what they did.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. So, I will say, out of 10 big ol' catfish, how would you rate Big Fish?
I know what Adam's gonna give it.
Well, I mean... 9.9
catfish. 9.9 big
Danny DeVito, like, werewolf. I mean, it kind of pulls me out of it, but the rest is just, like, it's stuff I grew up with. Like, you know, these Appalachian stories, you know.
Yeah.
I think I'd give it about 8. I really enjoyed it. There were a couple of things. Some of the accents were rough, and some of the moments, the werewolf stuff, a lot of the carnival stuff just was kind of... I mean, it was interesting, but it was a lot less... It was a little... Not boring, but... I don't know. It just wasn't as interesting as some of the other stuff in the movie.
Yeah, like... like, they didn't have to have him, like, going out of the can and being,
like you didn't have to... You
so
didn't have
times.
To show as much as they did.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like they could have paced it a little better in the middle section. But, I mean, there was still enough there that was really good that I'll give it an A. I would watch it again for sure.
Yeah.
I'd probably give it around an... since you brought a lot of that stuff up, I'm going to give it like an 8.8. First off, I'm not big into rewatching, unless it's a high action adventure, I'm not big into watching super dramatic films multiple times. This one you could probably watch. It has some rewatchability. Just
because of the comedy in it.
Yeah, and plus there's a lot of like things you can dissect in there, so I can understand rewatching it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Just to hear the daddy's gonna die story again.
That was just such a good story.
It's so well told.
You think you had a bad day and the milkman dropped dead on the door?
I would have to go with I think a solid 9 big old catfish out of 10. The only reason that I knock off one catfish is just because, kind of like you said, there were some moments that were a little less interesting, and there definitely were moments that went on longer than they, yeah, I think, should have. Because there were moments where I thought we were way further through the movie and we'd have to pause it so he could go let the dog out or something, and we weren't even halfway through, and I was like, whoa, okay, we got a long way to go. I wasn't sitting there like, oh my gosh, this is so long, but like it was moments like that where I was like, I think there's more of Tim Burton showing off his little like directorial abilities than was necessary in certain moments.
So there's actually a reason for that.
Okay.
Well, kind of, because in the book there's 4 stories about his death. Like there's my dad's death, take 1, my dad's death, take 2, and mm-hmm. my dad's, and all the way to take 4. And then there's how it happens. So, I mean, like so that you don't know when the story is going to end. You don't know when it's going to happen. Yeah. And yeah. I mean, there's also the thing about like it being different stories. Like each story has its own beginning and end.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you may feel like you're coming to the end of that story, but you might not be coming to the end of the whole movie.
Oh, of course. And I think, yeah, and I absolutely loved it. Like, it finished, and I was just like, wow. Like, it was really, really good. Yeah, I only knock it off just because, like, for anyone who can't sit through, you know, a long movie, or for anyone who has trouble with, like, timelines, because I know at one point Sam was like, I'm having trouble with timelines, and I'm like, I'm keeping up with these timelines just fine. Prestige is what messed me up with timelines. If you have trouble, like, keeping up with timelines, if you have trouble keeping up with, like, convoluted stuff, then like, you know, this might not be for you, but it has just so many like beautiful moments and beautiful performances by very, very talented people that I would still highly recommend watching it at least once. So that's why I give it like a solid like 9 out of 10 from me. Because I'm sure I'll end up watching this again at some point. I really, really, really enjoyed it. And like it actually got me, you know, it kind of like got me in the gut a little bit. And I was like, okay, yeah. If a movie can get me to the point where I'm like tearing up and thinking I'm gonna cry, then like, you did a good job, movie. Like, it's not the easiest thing in the world to do. But yeah, unless anyone has any final thoughts.
I think that's everything I have.
Another reason why I deducted that 0.1, I just want to say, catfish don't exactly make noises out of the water. Just want to say
no,
that.
No, they do not.
I mean, but then again, it is a story.
It is a story. Yeah. Anything can happen in the story. But yeah, so Adam, where can people find you?
So I'm on Instagram at AJFarmer_writes.
Writes as in like writing a book.
Yes.
Yeah.
W-R-I whatever. I can't spell. I failed all my spelling bees. You can also find me on Twitter with that handle. I mean, I mostly just post a bunch of wrestling stuff, but you can also listen to me on my podcast, again, Fiction Crime Time. And you can also follow the podcast on Instagram and Facebook at Fiction Crime Time. No spaces, no caps, just straight up at Fiction Crime Time. And follow us on Twitter at untrue_crime. Yeah, again, it's like a true crime podcast, but without the true part.
Nice.
Go have a listen.
I just subscribed.
There you go.
But yeah, this is our last week that we are accepting auditions for Call of Cthulhu. We close auditions 1 week from today when we are recording the podcast. We close auditions on March 14th. So if you have wanted to audition and you haven't yet, please do. We still have tons of roles to fill, and we are not making any final decisions about the rest of our casting until that day. We're keeping it open for anyone who wants to send in an audition for any of the characters, old or new, unless we've already cast them. So you can either message our social media, which is Instagram and Facebook at Mad Artists Entertainment, or you can message us on Twitter at artists_mad. Or you can just email us directly, auditions.madartists@gmail.com. If you have any questions, comments, corrections, or requests for what we should review in the future, email us at banterbox.madartists@gmail.com. Or again, you can just message us on our social media. If you participate in our virtual request line or you submit an actual request, you can come on the podcast just like Adam did today. Yeah, you can either just come on directly, you can submit little questions or audio clips or, you know, any of that good stuff. Be sure to send in auditions for Call of Cthulhu, follow us, and leave us a review on any of the platforms that you can. I don't know if Spotify even allows you to leave reviews.
They don't.
A bummer. So if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, definitely leave us a review. And I think we're also on Podbean, which I think is the Android equivalent of like the Apple Podcast app. I don't know if you can leave a review on there, but
Never heard of Podbean.
Please do. Well, people have been listening to us on there, so apparently it's a thing. So thank you guys so much for listening. And we are actually starting our movie musicals criticism series next Sunday. That's when we're going to be recording. So the Wednesday afterward will be when that's released. We're going to be going through different eras of musicals, and we're going to pick one success and one failure and pit them against each other. So next week we're going Golden Age. We'll still have our usual guessing game and everything, so I'm not going to spoil it for you. But if you're listening now, you get a little pre-hint. It is Golden Age for both of those musicals. All right, so thank you guys so much for listening, and we will see you next time. Bye!
Bye, everybody!